everyone, and welcome to the Belt and Road podcast, where we cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm your host today, Juliet Liu, coming from sunny Berkeley, California, and I'm joined by my co-host, Eric Maestrino. Hey, Eric, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Doing well.
And I'd just like to remind all of our listeners that before we start, to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter or Facebook, at Belt and Road Pod. It's where we post the latest news, research, and debates that are happening on China's growing presence in the developing world.
Definitely follow us. Eric posts a ton of great news. So today, I think this is a perfect interview to follow on our last episode, which discussed with Professor Linda Chia on the China-Europe Railway. So today we have Oyuna Baldakova. She is a PhD candidate at the Graduate School of East Asian Studies at the Free University of Berlin, and she's currently a visiting scholar at the Social Science Matrix at UC Berkeley. Her research focus is China's Belt and Road Initiative and its institutionalization in China and implementation in Central Asia. Her proficiency in Russian, Chinese, and English allow her to collect data through fieldwork, interviews, and the analysis of original sources. Oyuna previously worked in the field of international development cooperation, interning at UNESCO Bangkok, managing an EU-funded project for Central Asia, and running communications as a vice chair of the International Organization of Folk Art. She holds a master's degree in modern East Asian studies from Goethe University in Frankfurt. This episode, we're going to be talking to Oyuna about two articles that she wrote for the Merricks blog. The Merricks blog is a really great resource there. It's a blog written by the Mercator Institute for China Studies. And the first of her articles explores protests along the BRI, China's prestige project meets growing resistance. And then her second article that we're covering is called China's Central Asia Connection. She talks about what the rise of Chinese investment in Central Asia means for Europe. Oyuna, welcome to the Belt and Road podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Great.
Oyuna, first just to start us off, can you tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to study the Belt and Road and what your fieldwork has entailed? Where have you been able to go and what you've been studying?
Okay, so let's start from the very beginning. I have done my bachelor's degree in linguistics, studying English and Chinese languages in Russia, and then I learned the Chinese language in my bachelor's, and in my master's I continued focusing on the modern East Asian studies. Broader, engaging with a broader region. After my master's degree, I started working in international development consultancy, where we were advising the governments of Central Asia. So it was a project with the European Union. But unfortunately, during my 3 years of work, I could not use my Chinese knowledge, which I thought was a loss in a way. So in my PhD now, I try to engage both of my academic background in East Asian studies and Chinese language and the experience in development cooperation sector. That's why I view, and I decided to first study Chinese Aid, but then switch to Belt and Road Initiative as a representation of Chinese development finance. And in terms of field work, so for me, Belt and Road is sort of a black box, right? No, everyone is afraid of it. Or to an extent has a certain level of suspicion towards it. And no one knows really what's going on inside of it. So I decided to open the black box and go to China and interview a bunch of, well, academics first. Policymakers were not that easy to reach out for. Mm-hmm. But then I talked also to some of the banks and some of the SOEs, well, representatives of the SOEs. So I could engage on the Chinese side, but also part of my fieldwork was in Central Asia and Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, the two Central Asian states that border China. And there I also talked to a bunch of experts and, well, former policymakers and some of the state-owned enterprises.
Mm. Yeah, really fascinating. And your first article, which came out in December, it opens with this mention of Putin and Xi meeting in June of last year, talking of partnership, but how this meeting actually came in the wake of huge anti-China protests. And I think a lot of people in the West, or just broadly internationally, think of Russia and China as allied on many fronts, or at least kind of loosely aligned, not realizing a deep kind of historical tensions between China and the USSR. But also, yeah, you tell us this fascinating case of a Chinese water bottling plant on Lake Baikal in Siberia, and how this kind of added to a momentum of existing popular anti-Chinese sentiment.
Well, I first have to make a disclaimer. I come from the region close to the Baikal Lake, so I'm pretty much personally involved with the story, and I looked closely at the situation there. So they had the protest erupted back in March 2019. What led to it was a mix of different actors politicizing and instrumentalizing the story of Chinese-funded water bottling plant on the Lake Baikal. So what I have observed was that you have a mix of different actors who were trying to profit off a story, right? You had the Russian oligarchs interested in selling the water of the Baikal Lake, which is a freshwater lake, to the Chinese market themselves and not let Chinese do that. Also, you had the political infighting between the parties on the ground. So in Irkutsk region, close to the Baikal Lake, you have two strong parties that compete for power, and each of them, because of the upcoming elections and during their political campaign, they were using this story of Baikal and trying to push against, you know, the popular Chinese anti-Chinese sentiment that you have broadly in Siberia, I would say. The issue of xenophobia, I think, runs through many of the central, not only Central Asian states, but also the states on the north of China. So you in Siberia, in Russia, also in Mongolia, you have people who are afraid of China because of their number, because of the historic, like the number of Chinese people. Mm. Having these scarcely populated vast lands, they're afraid the Chinese would come and take over. Basically, this is the one of the fears. But also that, so the economic dependency is one of the issues. There are several concerns that people have, right? So this is kind of on the ground story. And when we speak about, say, Xi Jinping and Putin having this, you know, the best relationship on the top political level, this is the case. And we can say that, well, because we have so many, currently there are quite a few big investments projects from China to Russia, especially in the energy sector. Yes, that's the case on top level. But when it comes to the kind of bottom level, the level of the people, then you have a different story.
Right.
Yeah, that's really interesting. There's these dominant narratives within the Belt and Road and China with its money and its expertise. And it's a foregone conclusion that if there's an investment there, that there'll be specific influence. But it rarely ever takes in the local point of view and also the local politics that exist within that and taking that money and also the anti-Chinese sentiment that can be brought about from it.
Exactly, right. Yeah, and I also wanted to point out to two things that I noticed. So you have this broader overstory when it comes to the Baikal Lake, right? That it's damaging in terms of environmental situation on the lake. This is something that this is like a big story that took over the whole the protests. But the understory is the variety of actors involved, right? And them politicizing and promoting certain perspective of the project itself, because the project actually is not as damaging. Mm. Like there are certain environmentalists, I talked to them, they told me, okay, we have already a few other water bottling plant at the Baikal Lake. You have the Koreans, you have somebody else, right? There's another Russian plant there. So in itself, the idea is not as bad. It's a cheap and easy way of earning money. But the problem was that it's the Chinese who are coming, and it's also because of the certain political and economic tensions, right? You have all of this rising protest and sentiment.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of an earlier podcast that we had with Vanessa Lam and Nga Dao, who talk about how it's the Chinese hydropower projects that were protested in Myanmar. It was not, you know, Thai hydropower projects or projects by other people. It was specifically Chinese hydropower projects. So yeah, in this case, that was so fascinating. And
I also wanted to add one more point in terms of so Chinese companies going out and investing abroad. So here, especially with the case of this water bottling plant, there was one Chinese entrepreneur who actually got the money from one of the banks. I'm not sure which one exactly. So he decided, he found business partners in the Irkutsk region. So they started a joint venture. But the problem is, I think this Chinese business lacked understanding of the local reality, so he could not do enough preliminary work in figuring out what are the major actors and how to deal with them. So he, even though he got the green light from the Chinese government and Russian government, locally, like in that village, in that particular village, he could not work it out, and then it grew into a bigger protest. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
sounds eerily similar to somebody else's research that I know.
Yeah, totally misreading the local population.
And so that's really interesting. Within your pieces, you also touch on a couple cases in Kazakhstan where anti-Chinese sentiment has interfered with Belt and Road projects. Can you go into those in a little bit of detail?
All right. So when it comes to Kazakhstan, there was this one case that I'm talking about. There was, in a way, an information campaign or misinformation campaign, if you will, among the Kazakh population that was discussing the Chinese firms or Chinese factories coming to Kazakhstan and being established there. So the fear, the common fear was that, oh, the Chinese would outsource their dirty industries. They would build certain, environmentally unsustainable factories and bring them to Kazakhstan. So people were concerned with that, and then they started rallying. The problem here is, so they have discussed this list of 50 projects that would be realized in Kazakhstan over a certain, like over a long period of time, but and it happened long before the protest broke out. So I don't know how, but this information kind of trickled down to the messengers and the social media, and people were suddenly, you know, going out to the streets and protesting. And it started in Zhanaozen, it is an oil town in western Kazakhstan with a high unemployment rates, and people there, due to these rumors of the 55 Chinese factories, were kind of concerned that the Chinese would come and take over their jobs.
Yeah, I mean, I think this reminds me of like a common trend, I think, across places where it's funny because I think Chinese actors, especially Chinese entrepreneurs, often get good recognition by the Chinese government domestically if they can put a number on how big their projects are. And then it sounds really terrifying when it's when it's coming into other countries. And I just noticed too, like the protests that you're referring to in Zhanaozen, this was in 2011. So these are projects that were...
No, the protests happened in 2019.
Ah, okay.
Because here I refer to the, you know, there were bloody repression, but the there were the anti, you know.
This was where anti-Chinese sentiment started and then.
Well, to some extent, but there was like a huge oil industry there. And the people in 2011 were protesting, but then the government decided to, you know, use some weapons and they killed a lot of people. So there was like a bloody history that connected to protesting, but yeah.
It's really fascinating, and you kind of end towards the end of the article, you kind of have this comment that there's a real risk that more projects could be derailed for reasons other than the projects being ill-advised, and that this could feed a vicious circle as negative effects of projects gone bad reinforces anti-China sentiments. Going forward, do you see that vicious cycle continuing?
Yeah, I would say, I don't know if you followed the news, the latest news in Kyrgyzstan, is a neighboring country to Kazakhstan. They had a big protest connected to the special economic zone being established in the central part of the country. So these were again anti-Chinese protests of local population, and eventually they decided to scrap off the project. So they will not go further with that. And it's also connected to the fact that, say, in the case of Kyrgyzstan, you have a lot of investments into the mining industry, so the gold mining, etc. And often enough, these are the Chinese companies who bring their own workers, and the local population sees that, and they are again afraid of the influx of Chinese workers with their families taking over the land. So this is again the same kind of narrative of resource nationalism and people, you know, protecting their land basically. Mm-hmm. But this is again, it might have been, I have not done enough research on this case particularly in terms of the special economic zone. It might have been a good idea to have it established in Kyrgyzstan because it's a border country, and this is would have been a logistics hub, right? Which is potentially, from an economic theory, right, could have been a good spillover project. But now we cannot really say, I mean, if it would have been somehow beneficial for the local economy.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The special economic zones along the borders, I just find really, really interesting. This kind of brings us into your second article, which is called China's Central Asia Connection. Will you just give us a little bit of background as to why and in what ways Central Asia is really important to the European Union, which is your central argument, and why does that importance tend to be ignored by EU states?
The European Union, the current commission, positions itself as a geopolitical commission, so they want to be more assertive, I would say, on the international stage. They want to engage more with different parts of the world, and not only in terms of, you know, development cooperation, but also promoting their values and promoting their businesses abroad.
So that's geopolitical as opposed to what they were formerly, and just helping to stitch the nations together into the EU.
Right, exactly. So yeah. Exactly, yeah. Being more assertive geopolitically
as a unit,
and seeing the US looking more inward, they feel that they need to occupy a stronger position, so to say, on the international stage. So connecting to that, I was trying to argue that Central Asia is potentially a very strategic location for the EU to invest in and to be present in, because so far it's been some aid, right, and not enough economic cooperation. There are a lot of potential in the region. We have a 70 million people market. Mm-hmm. Potentially, you could have the global value chains established. You could also deal with the situation in Afghanistan, because Tajikistan, one of the Central Asian states, borders Afghanistan, and it's potentially a dangerous place.
Spoiled in conflict.
Exactly, in terms of conflict. So there are several reasons why EU should get more involved with Central Asia and actually commit to the region rather than just speak about the possibilities of engagement.
Within your second article, you make the case that the EU should be paying more attention to Central Asia, as we've talked about. And within that, there's a suggestion that China is winning, if you can say that, winning the race to gain influence there. A case could be made, though, that many of these infrastructure projects, such as the China-Europe Railway, actually benefits Europe while not really costing Europe much of anything, at least financially. What are the trade-offs for the EU of a stronger Chinese presence in Central Asia?
Well, yes, I would agree. Of course, it's beneficial for the EU to have smoother connection with China. But if we would consider Central Asia being in itself a strategic region for the European Union, and also seeing it from the perspective of businesses, say, because with the Chinese investments and involvement in Central Asia, they take over the market, they promote their products, they establish certain level of standards, right? They would potentially, if it comes to strategic infrastructure, they would set certain standards that might be different from the European ones. Also, you have the access to the market, the 70 million people market, and the global value chains that I mentioned. Also, if we would speak in terms of international relations or politics, you could see a shift in values, or there's always the discussion on the narrative of China promoting its values outside of the country and the EU kind of losing this kind of the ideological, if you will, battle in certain ways with China.
But you actually say in the article that Europe has a stronger soft power appeal in Central Asia. So, yeah, why is that? Why does China have? I mean, we understand the general reasons that China has some weaker soft power abilities in Central Asia. But why is Europe stronger, and how might the Belt and Road change that?
Well, we can look at it from different perspectives, right? But one of them would be, say, historical, where you had the Sino-Soviet split. Back in the 70s, where generally the Soviet propaganda was portraying China as something negative and evil, and the people growing up with the belief that China is a backward country of certain, you know, traditions that are not necessarily very quote-unquote civilized, etc., right? So you would have certain prejudices towards China, and again, the fear, right, towards China that is quite prevalent among the Central Asians. Also, why Europe has a stronger soft power? Well, economically, it's an important actor, right? Mm-hmm. And the European lifestyle, European standards, European economy is being perceived as something to strive for. So the Central Asian students or businessmen would come to Europe and try to learn from, you know, the Western ways, etc. So this is generally broadly perceived as something positive. So this is the war way, quote unquote war way, where Europe is winning. But with the Belt and Road, with the growing number of scholarships for students, with the growing number of the Confucius Institutes in Central Asia, you would say, well, Chinese are now trying to educate the people, the younger people, especially in terms of their language, their culture, etc. So you have an attempt to sway the popular opinions towards the you know, China.
Yeah, and you and I have spoken outside of this podcast before, but just mostly because you've been recently based at Berkeley, which has been great. I'm curious as to how you were perceived while you were doing your research, and if you have any fun stories of coming from Berlin, but being originally from Siberia, and if you have fun stories about people that you've met along the way that are offsetting some of our ideas that we might have as outsiders of the region.
Because I have done some work in Central Asia already, and I had some, you know, academic connections and professional connections, I was more or less familiar with Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan to some extent. And there, for example, I was doing my fieldwork in Almaty, which is the biggest city in Kazakhstan. It's not the capital, but it's a former capital in the south of Kazakhstan, bordering Kyrgyzstan. There, I was perceived as a local. So people, usually taxi drivers would immediately start speaking with me in Kazakh language. Mm-hmm. So even though Russian is fairly prevalent in the region, in Kazakhstan, but the local language, Kazakh language, is also widely spoken. Many people would assume that I'm from Kazakhstan and immediately speak to me.
So before you open your mouth.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Got it. That's interesting. And is China perceived in similar ways in Siberia than you would? Is there a different perception of China where you're from specifically than, say, in Moscow or in St. Petersburg in Russia? And do you think Siberia maybe is different or closer to perceptions of China in Central Asia? Or do you think there's some homogeneity to that?
Well, it's a difficult question.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
I didn't prep you for this
one. No, it's fine. It's good. It is a difficult question in the sense that I can speak from my region, right, where I come from. So it's called Buryatia. It's a republic bordering Mongolia. So we're close to Mongolian people and we share the culture and traditions of the Mongolian people. And we don't have a border with China.
Right.
And of course, in my region, or generally broadly, Siberia, far east of Russia, in the 90s, we had a lot of Chinese businessmen coming, but those were quite often low-skilled workers or people trying to sell very cheap Chinese products. So you would have certain type of Chinese people coming over. And this is the broader perception, I think, that stayed. So now there are more and more Chinese businessmen coming. So because the Russian ruble is not doing that well, and for Chinese, it doesn't make sense to come and work as guest workers in Russia, you would now have a different subset of Chinese people coming over. But the perception, I think, stayed that China is still a very like agrarian, poor country. So people are still afraid of the influx of the Chinese people. And I hear it's different on the border with China. So in the cities across the border in the neighboring Chita region and further to the east of Russia, you would have much more economic connections and people who travel often to China and observe the changes in the society, changes in the economy. They would, of course, have different opinions. Mm. But it really depends, I think, on your proximity to the region and how often have you been there, or things like that.
And what about Chinese perceptions of Central Asia or Chinese perceptions of Russia?
Oh, these are different regions, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, they know the people I spoke with, so the experts and you know, academics, they would often understand that it's a post-Soviet, Central Asia, post-Soviet, right, speaking Russian. Mm-hmm. They would not know much. I think Kazakhstan probably is one of the more famous countries in Central Asia. And you have, say, connections in Xinjiang. So the Xinjiang has a lot of Kazakh and Kyrgyz nationals who live there. So there's a much stronger local connection between Xinjiang and Central Asian states rather than, say, Beijing and Central Asia. So again, this is a regional proximity, geographic proximity makes quite a big difference.
And you even make a very short mention of Central Asian perceptions of China shifting because of the treatment of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. Right. Do you think have you seen evidence that that's having an effect on perceptions of China in Central Asia?
Definitely.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this is a very widely discussed topic. You had several cases when there would be Kazakh nationals fleeing from Xinjiang and asking for protection in Kazakhstan, for example. And then eventually they would not be granted asylum. And one of them now lives in Sweden, I think, so she eventually managed to go further and get European asylum. But in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, the governments there are, well, broadly Central Asian governments are not necessarily able to stand against the Chinese, say, in terms of a situation in Xinjiang, or ask or demand politically, openly, or officially demand certain changes. They would tell you, oh, we discuss it behind the closed doors, and we, of course, you know, try to communicate within the ministries, etc., but nothing was done on the, you know, public level. That's why the population is rather concerned.
Yeah, rightly so.
Within the protests that happened based on Belt and Road projects or Chinese state-financed, you know, large infrastructure or special economic zones that happened throughout Central Asia, I'm sure each case is different, but within the fieldwork that you've done and what you've seen, rhetorically, does the anti-Chinese sentiment come out as, you know, a localized, you're taking away our jobs, this sort of thing? Or is the plight of Uyghurs in Xinjiang also mixed in within the protest to the localized concerns of this infrastructure being built on somebody's land?
I think, like, when I did my fieldwork, it was 2018. The situation in, like, the media coverage on Xinjiang was not yet that big. So the people would not necessarily speak about Xinjiang directly. But you have, of course, a difference of perception among, say, different actors. You have the political elite who is more engaged with China, of course, who see China as a source of cheap money and good for their own businesses, etc., etc. Then you have businesses themselves who look at China as potential, again, being part of the, like, either global value chains or having businesses with China, etc. So this is a more positive perception, I would say. And people who are less engaged with China, or who've never been there, or, you know, losing their jobs to the Chinese workers, then of course would see it differently.
It was so interesting, Oyuna. Will you stick around for recommendations with us?
Sure. Yes, I have a few.
Wonderful. Can't wait to hear him. You've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast. Today's guest was Oyuna Baldakova. She's written two articles most recently from the Merrick's blog. Please check them out. They'll be in the show notes. And as always, follow us on Twitter or Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. Juliet, do you got any recommendations for us today?
Yeah, my recommendation for this week is chuangcn.org. It's a website, and they also have a journal, which has come out with two issues so far. And they also have a shorter form blog that is a little bit more responsive to current events. But it's just amazing coverage of economic history of China. They describe themselves as analyzing the ongoing development of capitalism in China, its historical roots, and the revolts of those crushed beneath it. They go on to say that their main focus is Chinese news of interest to those who want to break beyond the bounds of the slaughterhouse called capitalism.
Goodness.
So not really sure what their politics are. Just kidding. It's very clear. but they have a recent blog piece called Social Contagion, Microbiological Class War in China. And I just think it's a nuanced discussion of the economic dimensions of quarantine under the coronavirus. And I found it really thought provoking. And it's worth going on just for the incredibly beautiful photography that they have on the website. So high recommendation from me.
Love it. Oyuna, do you have some recommendations today?
So there is a book coming up, I think in March, called China's Western Horizons by Daniel Markey. He's a researcher at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he did his field work in Central Asia, so he focuses on Chinese investments to Central Asia. I have not yet read the book, but I'm looking forward to it. It will be published, I think, in March. And I've heard he interviewed some of my friends in Kazakhstan, so that's why I'm recommending it. So he'd done extensive field work himself. The second recommendation would be a movie. So it's a Kyrgyz movie called The Song of the Tree. It's a historical musical. So it's a musical about Kyrgyzstan, history of Kyrgyzstan, history of one of the families. It's a movie by Aybek Dayrbekov, and it's, if you will, a historical La La Land of Central Asia. It's a beautiful movie. If you have a chance, I would totally recommend it.
Awesome. What about you, Eric?
I have two today. First one is by a wonderful organization called Inclusive Development International. Last month, they put out the Community Guide to the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. It's actually a guide that's to be used by local communities who are affected by AIIB projects, but it also works itself as just a really wonderful primer on the AIIB itself, but also how the AIIB functions and works in more gritty detail, but not overbearing gritty detail. So it's a really wonderful resource. And secondly, I thought after Marriage Story and Parasite, there wouldn't be a better film in 2019, but I might have found it with the, or I didn't find it, but I might have seen it, Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Oh, no.
It was so brilliantly shot, a French film. It was done all with natural lighting, and it's a perfect data point as to why diversity in positions of power is important. Because not only the film itself and the creators of it were all women, but the story was all done almost entirely without the male gaze or men being involved. And it's a period piece, but it's like a period piece. I usually hate those, but it was unlike any others I've ever seen. And it was thought-provoking and erotic and smart and just, you need to see it. So, Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Awesome. I've heard good things too.
Oh, Yuna, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you very much.